This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Over the weekend, Chief Justice William Hubbs Rehnquist died at his home in Virginia. He was 80. And today, President Bush nominated Judge John Roberts to replace him. Roberts was previously nominated to replace retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Joining us to talk about the court's 16th Chief Justice and African-Americans are Harvard Law Professor Charles Ogletree and Ted Shaw, President and Director Counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Gentlemen, thank you so much and welcome.
Hello, Farai. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So we want to spend some time on the legacy of Justice Rehnquist, but first, let's ask the big question. Why has Judge Roberts, who until today was just a nominee for an associate justice, been so swiftly moved to the front of the line for Chief Justice?
Well, I think it makes sense from the administration's point of view. They wanted to have somebody in place by the first Monday in October when the court begins its new term. And they don't want the court coming into session without new leadership that they have chosen. If they did not replace Chief Justice Rehnquist, then Justice Stevens would be the acting Chief Justice. I don't think that's something they want. And they don't want the vacancy, period. In terms of Justice Roberts' renomination for Chief Justice, it's not really a surprise. I think that there were three options. One was to elevate one of the current sitting associate justices. The other was to nominate somebody fresh to be chief. But John Roberts is a known quantity. He's been vetted, and they have a lot of confidence in his intellectual ability. And he's going to be on the court for 30 years if he's confirmed as chief now. So for them, it's a move that I think has a lot of logic to it.
Let's talk a little bit about the special role of a chief justice. What, in fact, is the obviously all of the Supreme Court justices are incredibly powerful in shaping legal policy, but what does the chief justice do?
I think some people overstate and others understate the role of the chief justice. One of the most important roles, of course, if he or she is in the majority in an opinion, they choose who will write the actual opinion. That's a very important substantive piece of power. Chief Justice Rehnquist had an important role in that he has changed the court's role dramatically from what it was when he joined the court. The court was hearing probably 160 or more cases in the 70s, and that he's cut that number down to about 80 cases a year. So they're really very selective in what they hear, which means a lot of cases that many people may think have merit will never get any attention before the Supreme Court. But the other thing that's important, and Chief Justice Rehnquist did this with great class and with great effect, he really spoke strongly about the importance of the independence of the federal judiciary, seeking pay raises for judges who, ironically, some federal judges are making less money than my law students who graduate after being in a law firm and go into private practice, and that's a serious concern. But it also it helps to set the tone for the court in terms of where it's going to go. Given John Roberts' record as a judge and as a lawyer, it clearly will make this court swing even further to the right than it might have been with Chief Justice Rehnquist. And my only quibble with my dear friend Ted Shaw is that I think Roberts will serve not 30 years, but perhaps 40. The changes in health and age and all of that, he will be there for a very, very long time, and he will have a major impact on the direction of the court as we look forward.
Charles, let me just ask you, I don't want to go too deep into talking about Judge Roberts before we get to Rehnquist, but you say that he, as a Chief Justice, will swing the court further right. What makes you believe that?
His record, his disposition, his views, his associations, his opinions, the memoranda that he's written, whether in the Solicitor General's office or working in the White House or any other capacity. He has been consistently and unequivocally conservative in every time he's expressed his points of view. And there isn't a whole lot of equivocation there. Now, he has a right to be conservative, and President Bush won the election. He has a right to appoint him. But we shouldn't be fooled in thinking that Roberts is going to be anything different than a conservative based on his views about federalism, his views about affirmative action, his views about Roe versus Wade. And our hope is that he will follow the law as it has been established and not see this as an opportunity to swing more decisively to the right. But we shouldn't be fooled. He's a conservative. That's who President Bush wanted to appoint it. That's who he has appointed. And that's who will be, I think, the Chief Justice come October 3rd, 2005.
I want to lead both of you gentlemen through the legacy of Chief Justice Rehnquist. Let me start with you, Ted. When William Rehnquist was nominated as an associate justice to the bench by Nixon in 1971, there were questions about his role as director for the Republican Party's Operation Eagle Eye, what was called a ballot security program. Tell us a little bit, if you can, about what that was, and was it appropriate for a judge to be involved in that?
Well, there were questions about William Rehnquist's role in monitoring voters in Phoenix, where he was in private practice, and there were charges that he intimidated voters along with others, and all of that is in the record now. And I'm not sure this is a time to go back and rehash all that. I'll just say that Chief Justice Rehnquist has been remarkably consistent over the years, from the time he was a law clerk through the time you're talking about when he was in private practice, through his time on the bench. I have one difference with my good friend Charles Ogletree, which is I'm not sure that John Roberts will actually be any more conservative than Chief Justice Rehnquist was. He was very conservative, although I think that during John Roberts' time on the court, if he's confirmed, we may see the court move even further to the right as President Bush gets another appointment in addition to his, and there's always the possibility of more appointments. But Chief Justice Rehnquist's vote was one that we at the Legal Defense Fund would have been happy to have, but in almost every circumstance in major civil rights cases, we didn't get that vote. Now, there were a few cases in which he came our way. The Miranda decision was widely expected by some conservatives to be overruled. Chief Justice Rehnquist did not go along with that. But for the most part, he was a very difficult vote for us to get, but he certainly had a tremendous impact on the court, on the jurisprudence. He started as an outlier when he was appointed to the court. By the end of his life, he was right there in control of a very conservative court that may get to be even more conservative.
Ted, let me follow up and ask you about the affirmative action cases that the Chief Justice ruled on. How did he vote in the various affirmative action cases that came before?
Well, he was a reliable vote against affirmative action. Most recently in the Michigan cases, he certainly expressed his opposition to affirmative action, although in one of the opinions, the position wasn't as clear as perhaps it had been in some of the earlier cases. But he generally was very suspicious of affirmative action, if not antagonistic toward it. And that was consistent through even before Michigan, the contracting cases that were before the Supreme Court, the Adirondack case involving federal contracting and the Croson case involving municipal contracting in the city of Richmond. Although Justice O'Connor was seen as a swing vote, obviously this was the Rehnquist court, and he was a formidable intellect. So what he said had effect.
Let me ask you, Charles, about minority clerks. Judge Rehnquist never hired a single African-American among the 82 clerks that he had. 81 of those 82 were white, and he said, wait for the demographics to change. There's no need for a wider net. The system is working just fine. In your role as a Harvard law professor, do you find that acceptable? Do you find it acceptable that this pathway to the inner workings of the justice system has essentially been for many of the justices?
Well, let me answer it this way. Regrettably, Chief Justice Rehnquist was not the only Supreme Court justice to not hire African-American clerks. And in fact, some of our liberal friends who served on the courts in earlier times also did not hire African-American clerks. The good news is, despite what Rehnquist has said and failed to do, is that many members of the court, from Justice Stevens Justice Breyer in particular, Justice O'Connor, other judges have hired African-American clerks, and it's a much better day. I've had a number of students who are exceptional. They're not special admits or special qualified folks. They're really brilliant students. I'm glad that the court is having a little bit more diversity. But that is a problem because you want the court to look like America. You want the law school to look like America. You want the law firm to look like America. And that's one of the disappointments. About Rehnquist, though, let me just say this about the legacy. First of all, when he was initially ill, I sent a letter to him expressing my deep regrets about his illness, and I send my condolences out to his family now. He was a very brilliant man. He was number one in his class at Stanford. He actually wrote a brilliant essay for a book that Deborah Rohde at Stanford and I co-edited called Brown at 50, talking about praising Earl Warren, who wrote the unanimous decision in Brown versus Board of Education in 1950. He handled the impeachment hearings of President Clinton with excellence. His public scholarship on the courts and society were phenomenal. But Ted is right. His decisions is where it made a difference. He was the Lone Ranger. He was out there in dissent. He wrote he was in the majority in Bush versus Gore that stopped the vote in Florida in 2000. Against affirmative action in the Michigan case, one of the two dissenters in Roe versus Wade. He has carefully and effectively over the last 33 years cut back on the exclusionary rule, giving police more power and suspects less power. And when it comes to racial profiling, people have to be very concerned that the court has moved in a very, very conservative area that provides less protection to people than before. So that's part of the legacy. It's a mixed legacy, but when it comes to issues of race and justice, I think folks are going to be less congratulatory and more critical, but the overall legacy will be shaped up as someone who stuck by his views over a very, very long period of time.
Let me ask you about whether or not the Bush administration is going to feel pressure to nominate a woman or a person of color or both for Sandra Day O'Connor's seat. Sandra Day O'Connor herself expressed some dismay that a woman was not nominated. Now that Judge Roberts is being nominated for the Supreme seat, if you'd put it that way, is the Bush administration going to feel pressure to take a second look at the diversity of the court?
I think they'll feel pressure, but that means nothing. Laura Bush appealed to him. Hispanic community appealed to President Bush, and he seemed to be taking those views into consideration, but he nominated John Roberts, not Edith Clements, not Alberto Gonzalez. So I think there will be pressure, but he doesn't have to run again, and he wants to formalize his legacy as a president. And I think even though there will be pressure, that won't ultimately influence his choice. I think what's interesting is that if the Robert hearing, since it's been elevated, is as contentious and as demanding as we anticipate, we may see on Monday, October 3rd, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor as the ninth justice, and she will serve until there's a replacement. That's not a bad thing for her to continue in that role, but I think that ultimately the president will nominate a second person, and I hope that he does look at the court and to make sure that his legacy, as he claims it was in Texas, as he promised it would be in the White House, as he's done with Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and Alberto Gonzalez and others, that the court will look much more diverse with talented people who are diverse in gender and ethnicity, and that should mean that someone unlike the men who are white on the court, will join the court and add some diversity sometime after October.
Ted, what do you think the chances are for more diversity on the court?
Well, I think that there will be some pressure in the minds of some to appoint a Latino or a woman or a Latina or something like that. But I agree with Charles. I don't think that the president is going to feel a lot of that pressure. He's going to appoint whom he wants to appoint. From my view, my concern isn't so much whether we have a Latino or another African-American or a woman. That's important. I don't mean to say that it's not. But I want somebody on the court who, although they're conservative, is fair, open-minded, whose vote is in play, who will hear the arguments, who does not come to the court with a mission-driven agenda. That's what the Legal Defense Fund said we wanted with respect to the Roberts nomination. It's what we want with respect to any justice. That's important. I do want to take this moment, though, to say that we also send out our condolences on a personal level to the Rehnquist family. Whatever disappointments we had with getting the Chief Justice's vote This is a time for us to recognize that they've suffered a loss, and the nation is in mourning, and we join folks in sending condolences.
Let me, we're running out of time now, just ask a broader question, which is, you two gentlemen obviously are legal experts, legal scholars, and legal issues have always been inextricably tied to the advancements of African Americans in this country. How important is it for ordinary citizens to understand these decisions that the court makes? They are always very complicated, and they flash across the front pages. What can people do to better educate themselves about these decisions?
I think that's the most important question, because we keep thinking that the Supreme Court is this high and supreme entity that's removed from the people. I remember a slogan, I think it's in the Florida Supreme Court, that said, "The court is where the injured flock for justice." And I think the court is very important in every aspect of our lives, our rights of privacy, whether we're going to be taxed, whether we can get an education or a job, whether we face discrimination. And so even though those 80 decisions may not impact us every single day in every single way, the court does enact the supreme law of the land, and I think that we need to see it as more importantly. We knew before November 2004 that whoever became president would select two, three, or maybe even four Supreme Court justices by 2009, when the term officially ends for the presidency. So it's very important, and it affects our everyday lives. Cases of like what's going to happen to the tragedy that's going on in the Gulf Coast and Florida and Alabama and Louisiana and Mississippi now, that's going to come before the court in some way. Questions about whether or not the terrorism concern that's a international concern will have some domestic impact on people's rights of privacy.
All right, I'm going to have to stop you there. Unfortunately, Ted, I don't have another second. I just want to thank you both so much. We are going to obviously keep on the story of the Supreme Court as it evolves. Ted Shaw, President and Director Counsel for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and Charles Ogletree, Law Professor at Harvard University. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.